Now I will start.
So, first of all, first of all, today was supposed to be Van der Veen, but it's me and then Roland. Okay, we'll see how far I will go, we'll see how much time is left. Unrelated question completely, I'm using it for public announcement. I have a spare keyboard cover, like red, like this one for my laptop, which is AZERTY. If anybody wants something like that, it's yours. Next, before we really start, so I think one of the main purposes for tomorrow will be to go over our to-do list, which is rather long. So I wanted to display it ahead of time so that you can, well, and it's also on the handout, so you can read it and decide if there is something that you want us to concentrate on, ask something, okay? So, okay, next, so I just like to remind you where we were. So we had this zipping formula. So given a, I don't have the remote, but I can still use the laser pointer. So we defined the zipping of a power series relative to a variable, and it really means contract wherever you see this variable, contract it with its dual at a sign and replace both of them by one. And if the variable appears seven times and the dual appears a different number of times, you get zero. But if the variable appears seven times and the dual appears seven times too, then you sum over all ways of pairing them, which just amounts to saying that all of them disappear and you're left with 7 factorial, which is, I think, 5040. Okay? If you are contracting genuine polynomials, then it's just an exercise with differentiation. You can rephrase it using differentiation. So this is easy. But we have a theorem saying that you can contract things which are much harder than polynomials, specifically Gaussian, perturbed Gaussians. So the statement was, if P is a polynomial, this is the perturbation, which is of finite degree in the zetas, I don't care what degree it is in the z's, and you multiply it by a Gaussian in the z's and the zeta, so here's the quadratic piece, and then there is a linear piece with the zetas, a linear piece with the z's, and the constant term. I could have swallowed the constant term into the p, but it's sometimes more convenient to have it here. Then this contraction is equal to the determinant of q tilde times da 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 da, where q tilde is the inverse matrix of 1 minus the matrix that appears in the quadratic of the Gaussian. And the main point in this formula is that it is a finite formula. So if you look at it very carefully, here zetas appear in the exponential, but here they appear only still in the polynomial, in the perturbation. So there are still finitely many zetas in this formula, so you can get the answer using differentiation. Okay? Questions, comments? Good. So, the next thing I wanted you to remember is that, the point was that we wanted to understand functions from one symmetric algebra to another, and we said that was the same as elements in the symmetric algebra in B dual, comma, B prime, so really power series in variables, sort of zeta-ish variables and zeta and z-ish variables. So zeta-ish means Greek and z-ish means Latin. And the claim is that if f is coreasonable, so if f is linear and continuous just means that it doesn't lower degrees it doesn't mess up with the grading. So if something is of high degree, it remains, its output is high degree, okay? So basically, whenever you have such an f, the tensorial representation of f, so the power series in the zetas and the z's, is simply you take f and apply it to an exponential. So all you need to ever know is how to compute with exponential, how to compute exponentials, okay, and how to apply the zipping formula. And then the final reminder for today is this algebra QU, which essentially Roland introduced in his last talk. But let me remind you what it is. And in fact, I think we still owe you a justification. Why is it really, really natural? It is natural. But we still owe you a justification. But even before that, a complete justification, but even before that, let me just tell you what it is. And in fact, you can immediately forget afterwards what it is. Okay? It's just, I mean, if you actually calculate, you need to know what it is. But, okay? So basically, it's the algebra generated by y, a, x, and t, four generators. This, by the way, is always the order by which I write the generator. So this is the PDW order that we tend to use. If you want to know why yax, okay, t is irrelevant. T is, the relations are that t is central. I forgot to write it. So t you can place wherever you want. But then we have to choose the order of the yax. And if you really want to know why we chose the order yax, the answer is because earlier we had a version with cu and w, and the order was a cow. And then we had a version with E, L, and F, and then we put them, we chose the order to be ELF, because that was a talk I gave on Christmas at some point. So I wanted it. So then we decided to be serious and talk mathematics, and we really had to use the letters Y, A, and X, because all the other letters were used for better things. But then we had to choose the order, and the only order that makes sense is clearly YAX. Okay?
YAX is better.
Yeah, yax is a yak, I know, that's why. So, okay. Anyway, so the relations are A commute with X is gamma times X. And later I will set gamma to 1, so it doesn't really matter. A commutes with Y is negative gamma times Y. And XY minus QYX, I don't know why it's inside of brackets here, is equal to one minus ta squared over h bar. H bar is some parameter, where q is really the exponential of h bar, but multiplied by gamma and epsilon. Gamma and epsilon are two other so really the algebra depends on three parameters: gamma, epsilon, and h bar. H bar is the thing that carries degrees, that makes things converge. Gamma is really for symmetry with epsilon, and I will later set it to 1. And epsilon is crucial. So epsilon will be the one that will go to 0. And t is the is really the exponential of lowercase t, where actually, if you want to relate it with Roland, the lowercase t is what he called epsilon a minus gamma b, and the main property that he has is that it's central. So uppercase t is the exponential of lowercase t. Uppercase A is the exponential of lowercase a, but with an epsilon thrown in. And then for convenience, for later use, I also want the exponential of lowercase alpha, alpha being the dual of a, and it actually hasn't appeared yet. So I will call it uppercase alpha. I mean, this is the letter that's normally called calligraphic a, but I want to think of it as uppercase alpha, the exponential of alpha. Okay? Now, the algebra QU also has a coproduct and an antipode, and they're given by these formulas. Okay? Again, Roland derived this, but even if he didn't derive this, here it is, the full thing. Okay. So, you know, I want to tell you mathematics, but I want to tell you the mathematics via calculations. So bear with me. I will speak about computing, but there will be mathematical morals to what I will say. Okay? So here is the program.
So when the previous thing is not on the handout, or is it somewhere?
No, it's not on the handout, unfortunately. Sorry.
It's on my handout.
Okay, sorry. So it's... Sorry.
Okay, I think I admitted on day one that sort of everything was last minute for us. Anyway, so the program is on the handout, and I don't want to go through it. I only want to go through small parts of it. But if you look at the handout, the program is made of various sort of subsections, and I'll just tell you what they are. So there is some initialization and utilities, things that are kind of generally used but have no specific place. Then there is a command called declare algebra, and declare algebra allows you to declare any algebra. Well, subject to some restrictions. So, in fact, if you have an algebra you want to study with this program, you can use declare algebra to declare it. Likewise, there is declare morphism, meta operations I'll skip. Then there is the declaration of the algebra CU, which I will not discuss today, but is the classical counterpart of QU. Then there is the declaration of QU. Then there is a representation of CU, which I will not use, but it's handy to check to use things. Then there is one of the most crucial pieces, the swap element. And I will explain later why it's one of the most crucial pieces, but I did define it earlier. Okay, I did explain what it does. And then there is how to compute exponentials, because remember, everything hinges on computing exponentials. Then there is zip and bind and bind. Then there are finding the tensorial representations, and then a few alternative algorithms that I didn't want to erase, even though they're not used. And finally, there is a minor utility. What did I do here? There is a minor utility that's not on the handout that I've added, so I had to display it, even though you really don't want to know about it. It just converts alphas, exponentials of alphas, to uppercase alphas. So I just needed it to make some formulas look nicer. And the program is now in. And let me do the first two things that I want to do. I want to set gamma to 1. Right? Gamma was the sort of the uninteresting coupling constant. So I want to set it to 1. And epsilon is always near 0. So I have to tell you how far from 0 it is. Okay? So dollar k is the highest power of epsilon that I will care about in any computation. So basically, saying that dollar k is equal to 1 mods out by epsilon squared is equal to 0. Okay? So you don't see it, but this happens within the program. So let me perform these things. And sorry, the computer, the file has to initialize. It takes a few seconds. And why is it taking more than a few seconds? Oh, done. Good. Sorry, that was just Mathematica starting up, essentially. Okay? And okay, so now all computations that we do are up to epsilon squared is equal to 0, or up to epsilon to the 1. I could have set dollar k to be more, but if I had done so, you'd have to wait more for each computation, and also each computation will just flash the screen with lots of garbage and you will not be able to see anything anyway. Okay, so first let me compute the tensor corresponding to the multiplication. So basically, I'm computing M1, 2, 1, the tensor corresponding to it. And I remind you that it should sort of look like the archetypal multiplication that we talked about before. So it has two inputs, tau1 and tau2, and one output, zeta1 and zeta2, and one output, z. So it should roughly look like e to the zeta 1 plus zeta 2 multiplying z 1. But of course, not. That's the abelian version. Okay? So let's see what it actually looks like. The program computes it. I didn't yet tell you how. I have to tell you. I mean, I will tell you later. But here is the output. Oi. That's a bit hard to read. Should I increase the font size? Let me increase the font size.
Okay, here is the output.
So, okay, I actually have four zeta variables, and remember, right, there are four zeta variables. So there is the, or four z variables, there is t, a, x, and y, the four generators. So from the perspective of a, I have, oh, sorry, this is t in one multiplying by 2 into 3. So really, sorry, I wrote here the wrong thing. This is 3, so this should have been 3 as well. So here is the term where alpha 1 and alpha 2 merge to become a 3. Here is the term where tau 1 and tau 2 merge to become t 3. Here is the term, oh, and I should have said, the output is written in the form, instead of written like an exponential, it's written in some in a form e of one thing, then a second thing, up to the comma is the first thing, then a second thing, and then a third thing. And I think I have to explain what it is. I think it's actually explained here somewhere, but even if it isn't, let me explain what it means. So basically, E of L, Q, and P stands for the exponential of L plus Q times P. So basically, L and Q are two pieces of the quadratic. For some reason, I wanted to split it in two. And P is the perturbation. Okay? So the quadratic has kind of, in a boring way, the A and T piece, and then slightly more exciting, the X and Y piece. So here is Y3 times eta 1, and here is Y3 times eta 2, but unfortunately divided by uppercase alpha 1, which is, what is it, E to the epsilon alpha. Okay? So it's, if it wasn't for this annoying factor, we'd be in business. Likewise, here, so it's psi 1 with x3, and here it's psi 2 with x3, but this term has a perturbation on it. Yeah?
It's an epsilon alpha, that's not right, is it?
What did I say?
No epsilon.
Oh, no epsilon, sorry, it's a gamma alpha. Sorry, it's, sorry, I said it wrong. Okay. And finally, there is an extra piece that we didn't expect, but if you think of it, it should remind you of the vial of the Heisenberg algebra and the vial term that appears in it. And that's half of what creates mess. And finally, here is the perturbation. It's a power series in epsilon, which ends with O of epsilon squared. The first term is 1. This is the term proportional to epsilon. It's a huge mess. The only thing I can say about it is that it's a polynomial in the relevant variables. Okay? No, I can say more about it, but for now, it's a polynomial in all relevant variables. But that's not the form we like. Okay? The form we like was... okay, so in other words, strictly speaking, this isn't a quadratic in the variables because A1, the uppercase A1 depends on alpha 1, which is one of the variables. So this isn't a quadratic, right? It looks like y times eta, but it's y times eta times more factors of alpha. That's not quadratic. Okay? But if you think about it a little more, you find that you can view it as a quadratic in two different ways. So first of all, you can think of and actually the two ways commute, so I'm saying first of all, but it doesn't matter in which order you do it. Okay? So you can think of it, first of all, as, basically you can think of it as if you're holding the y eta, so basically there are two sets of variables that appears here. There is the y psi x and eta on one hand, and t alpha tau and a on the other hand. Okay, so it turns out that it's nice to split into these two sets, and if you hold these variables as if they are constant, then the L piece, the first piece, is a quadratic in the other variables, and you can think of the rest as being a legitimate perturbation because it is. Okay? And on the other hand, if you, and you know, yeah. And on the other hand, if you hold these variables fixed, then what remains is a Gaussian in the other variables. Okay? So in fact, if I want to zip such an expression, I can. My machine does it. But it would have to do it. Yeah, Roland?
But the legitimate perturbation is not a polynomial in the alpha.
So I'll come back to it in a moment. So you're annoying. Let me get back to it in a minute, okay? So I could still use my zipping machine, except I have to use it twice. One time for the L variables and one time for the Q variables, okay? And if you open the zip and bind part of the program, so let's go to the zip and bind part and see it, then you will find, okay, then it has some uninteresting definitions, then the dual of each variable is defined, and then there are actually two zip programs. There is QZIP, which looks exactly the same as the QZIP programs that I've, as the ZIP programs that I've shown yesterday, except it manages the Q part without touching the L part. And there is the LZIP program, which does the opposite. So basically, I've split the situation into two. Now, Roland is correct to say that if I regard the e to the q as part of the p for the purpose of the L zipping, so in other words, if I look at this as e to the L times e to the q times p and think of this as a perturbation, then I have a problem because the q contains, so the q here had coefficients which were uppercase alpha and uppercase t, and this really contains in it lowercase alphas, and this really contains in it lowercase t's. Okay? Now, but remember that in the zipping program, in the zipping lemma, one set of variables had to be of bounded degree, but the other set of variables could go to an arbitrary degree. So simply, I'm forced to decide that alpha and t are the kind that's allowed to go to any degree, okay? To arbitrary degree. So in fact, L-zip and implements the L-level zips. This is a comment, that's not a part of the program. The program is below and above. And L-zip implements the zips where the Z's are the T's and the alphas, and the zetas, which are supposed to be of bounded degree, are tau and A. Okay? So actually everything works. Okay? Sorry, I'm not sure if I can say much good about it, except, well, I mean, that's what life presents us with, okay?
that basically we have the zipping trick, and we need to apply it in some situation, and we have to do some gymnastics in order to do it. So do it twice and choose funny names for the variables. Okay, so that's one comment. And the other comment is, well, how was it computed? Right, this is the perhaps the most interesting question. How did the computer arise with this messy box? Okay? So the answer is that, part of the answer I don't want to show you. I want to show you as a mathematician, and then part of the answer I want to show as a program. So the part that I want to show you as a mathematician is, well, what do I really need to find? I need to compute, basically, remember, I only need to know how to work with exponentials. So I need to compute e to the eta 1 y1, e to the alpha 1 a1, e to the psi 1 x1, so that's sort of one input, and then multiply it by e to the eta 2 y2, e to, sorry, not y, not, not, just like that, sorry, I multiply in one algebra two inputs. So e to the eta 2 y, e to the alpha 2 a, e to the psi 2 x. So basically I need to carry out this computation. And the claim is that the answer is given by the ordering in the y a x order of the formula written above. Formula above. Okay? I suppose here over there I use subscript 3 for the output, and here I just simply left them without subscript. Okay? So basically, one needs to compute such things in a funny algebra. Now, so now let's open the TSW box and see how it's done. So here it is. And the first thing is actually a copy-paste from the handout. I'm sorry, that's not yet the program. That's a comment that I've added on the program. And the comment says, basically, that if you want to swap a y or an exponential of a y with an exponential of an a, you know how to do it. There is an explicit formula for how to do it. Likewise, if you want to swap an exponential of an a with an exponential of an x, you also know how to do it. Maybe I should have said first what is the overall goal. The problem here is that things are not in the right order. So basically I want to swap the x's over the y's. Basically I want to swap things until they are in order, and then I got the formula I wanted. So first step is I need to learn how to swap an exponential of y's against an exponential of a's, or an exponential of a's against an exponential of x's. And this is happening in a two-dimensional algebra, right? Basically, y and a then generate a two-dimensional subalgebra, or the universal enveloping algebra of a two-dimensional algebra. And the claim is that in the two-dimensional algebra, sorry, this cropped because I magnified stuff too much. So let me try to shrink it a bit. Yeah. So basically the claim is that in the two-dimensional algebra with these commutation relations, you have that e to the psi x times e to the alpha a is equal to e to the alpha a, e to the minus gamma alpha, e to the psi x. Okay? And if you don't believe me, first of all, it's on the handout, so it must be true. This is on the handout. And secondly, it's in the code for the program, and therefore it must be true. And third, here is a very, very quick proof, which you can read for yourself, and it's also on the handout, so you don't have to read it right now. It's really easy. Okay? So, in fact, this does go into the program. So, in the program, it goes as here, the swap of X and A is, well, it has some a Gaussian part in the L side, a Gaussian part in the Q side, which has coefficients coming from the L side. So this is this e to the minus gamma A, and no perturbation there, so it comes with 1. Okay. But then comes the real difficulty. All of this is trivialities. The real difficulty is how to swap e to the psi x with e to the eta y. This is the real hard thing. Okay? So I have e to the e to the psi x, e to the eta y, and I want to rewrite it in the form, in a form which is in YAX order, okay? And in fact, it was done in the case epsilon is equal to 0 in the handout and in my first talk, and this is this Weyl algebra computation. But unfortunately, epsilon is not equal to 0 and we get some harder mess, okay? However, being smart, I know what the mess is going to look like, or more precisely, having done lots of computation on the side, I know roughly what the mess is going to look like, and the issue is more to find the coefficients. Okay? So the mess is going to look like e to the eta y times some function f times e to the I don't want to write it as the function f. Let me just write the n's. Basically, I can swap them, but then in the middle, I will get some correction term. And the correction term is best written as the ordering in the YAX order of some function f, which is a commutative function in the variables y, a, and x. So f is some function, f is really f of y, a, x, and in fact also psi and eta, the parameters. So it's a function of everything that's around. Okay? And I want to find this f.
On the right it's psi x, right?
What?
On the right side.
Psi x, of course, yes, you're right. I mean, I flipped them, and the best place to write the mistake is in the middle. Okay? And the point is that whatever f is, if you multiply by e to the eta y, if you multiply and then by e to the psi x, you got the answer you wanted. You got the thing, you got the answer in YAX ordering. So the question is how to find this f. Well, this f, or more precisely the function f whose ordering should appear here. Anyway, so this OYAX of f is just, well, so you multiply on the left by e to the minus eta y and on the right by e to the minus psi x, and you find that it's equal to e to the minus eta y e to the psi x e to the eta y e to the minus psi x, and that's just the group commutator of these two exponentials. So really all I want is to compute a group commutator. Okay? Now, here again, I use some tricks. Oh, I'm sorry about that. So here again,
I use some tricks, and in fact the tricks are already on the screen, so I'm not sure why I should be, and they're also on your handout, so I'm not sure why I should be saying them. So let me put it in a larger font and explain. So again, my purpose is to compute this. So first I compute the result of conjugating y by e to the psi x. This turns out to be a finite sum. Basically because, there is lots of exponentiation, lots of Lie algebra tricks that one has to be aware of. But basically the one that's used here is that e to the negative x y e to the x, let me ignore the coefficients, okay? Is equal to e to the add x applied to y. And add x applied to y has a very simple form times epsilon. So if you do it n times, you get, so basically after you do it a number of times, since epsilon is nilpotent, you get zero. So this is a finite sum. So you just compute this. But then, the moment I know this, I can exponentiate it. So the exponential of that is, so if you exponentiate it, the answer is e to the minus x, e to the y, e to the x, that's the next thing that I want to compute. I want to compute, So let's call this quantity g, and then e to the x, no, sorry, what do I want to say? E to the negative y times the exponential of g is the quantity I really care about, is x. Okay? But I should have said that everything here still depends on eta. So it's e to the minus eta y, and g is really also a function of eta. So now I want to find this function g that satisfies this, and this turns out to be a differential equation. So at eta equal to 0, it's easy to find that g is equal to probably 1. Sorry, that f is equal to 1. Sorry, g is found. I need to find f. So at eta equal to 0, f is equal to 1. And then you can differentiate f with respect to eta. And that's Leibniz's rule and differentiating an exponential and things like that. And you find that f satisfies the differential equation written here. Okay? And then, the other thing that I told you right at the beginning is that I'm a brute force guy. So that's this little picture at the upper right corner of the handout. So I have a differential equation. I don't care. I just brute force solve it. Namely, I write a few lines of computer code that simply generate the differential equation. Here is the term that you may recognize as the differential equation. I feed it into a differential equation solver, I get the output, and I go home. Now, you might complain that this is sort of, I have no control on how complex is it, okay? But the truth is that I don't care how complex this is, because this is a differential equation that you solve once. You solve it once in your life, I don't care how you do it, you find the switch element, and the computer printed it out so it actually works, and then you move on. Okay, yeah.
Question. If you change the order of nilpotency of epsilon, you get...
Yeah, so once for every order of in epsilon.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you expect to be able to solve it for order infinity? So the analytic case.
No,
Or in other words, maybe yes, in fact. Yes, I expect to, I know how to solve it to order infinity. It's a horrible mess you don't want to ever think about. Okay? So in fact, this power series that you get here, so, right, I wrote the answer over here as a power series, and I could easily compute it for the next, for k equals 2, it would just be a longer power series. It is the expansion of a function you can compute, because you can compute it for SL2, and it's a horrible mess, and you can compute explicitly an isomorphism between QU and SL2, and it's an even only multiplicative, and this is and it's an even more horrible mess. But you'll have nothing to do with it. It's much better to just have the answer. Okay?
I have another question. So here you're using this double algebra, also because you have this epsilon, which makes things easier because you can impose its nilpotency.
Yeah.
What happens if you don't have such an epsilon, like in the UQSL2 case here?
In a few minutes I will explain. I actually still haven't explained. Okay. Sorry. If epsilon is not nilpotent, you will lose the fact that P is a polynomial. Mm-hmm. Right? Everywhere I have e to the L, e to the Q, or e to the L plus Q times P, you will lose the fact that P is a polynomial, and then the zipping machine doesn't work, and then you actually don't know what to do. At least I don't know what to do.
But stating that epsilon is not important doesn't mean that the sum is not convergent. You can still think in the iadic setting. Which is taking the limit.
Yeah, of course. So, but I thought your question was about thinking of epsilon as being a non-infinitesimal quantity.
Yes.
So, I don't know what to do.
Okay.
So, I mean, if you had here some special functions, somehow. The reason why everything works and works fast is because you stay within a very limited class of functions within which you can do computations. If you will start allowing into P, basically arbitrary analytic functions, you don't know how to compute anything. Okay? Okay. I think that's all I have to say about that. But now I can also compute the tensor corresponding to the antipode. Here it is. So again, it has the same general form. So it looks like the naive antipode, negative A1 alpha 1, negative T1 tau 1. And this is actually also the naive antipode with some L factors from the L side thrown in, and then multiplied by a horrible exponential. Okay? And then you can ask again, how was this computed? And the answer is, again, all I need is to know how to compute the antipode of e to the eta y, e to the alpha a, e to the psi x. Antipode is an anti-homomorphism, so it's e to the psi, the antipode of x, e to the alpha, the antipode of alpha of a, e to the eta, the antipode of y. Now you look back at the formulas defining the algebra, and you find that the antipode of x is a messy expression with sort of terms that don't commute well with each other. This is easy, actually, and this one again is a messy expression. But at the end, all I need to compute is exponentials. How does one compute exponentials? You solve a differential equation. Okay? So if you look into the exponentials as needed box,
So the programs that computes exponentials, then again, I'm just using completely brute force. Here it is. You again set up a differential equation. It's a complete mess how to set it up. But at the end, you run some differential equation solver, dissolve, you solve it, you're done. And again, the fact that it's ugly, I don't really care. It is run only once at each level, okay? Finally, there is the antipode. Sorry, not the antipode, the coproduct. And again, it's the same principle. So you just need to know the coproduct applied to this. It becomes a certain product of coproducts. It's a differential product of exponentials. It's a product of differential of things which you can solve by differential equations. In fact, the same program does it. Okay, and finally, there are the R matrix and the inverse R matrix, and the quap and the inverse quap, and essentially these we input by hand. Basically, the R matrix is given by Roland wrote it last time. It's given by some exponentials and quantum exponentials, and we the quantum exponentials depend on Q, and Q depend on epsilon. So we need to know how to expand quantum exponentials, with respect to the epsilon that appears in the Q. And fortunately for us, Fadeev did it 25 years ago, 30 years ago. So we just copy his formulas. And that's what we get. The handout actually has, at the end, around here, under Fadeev's formula, it has both the explicit formula and the two-line proof. It's not hard. It's a two-line proof. Three, four, maybe. Okay? This is it. So now we can start testing. So let's test the associativity of multiplication. Multiplication better be associative. Roland, how am I doing?
Just fine.
No, time-wise. Am I running out?
Just keep going, it's okay.
Okay.
This needs to be said anyway.
Okay. So basically I need to take the multiplication of 1 and 2 into 2, bind it along variable number 2, or B sub 2 is a binding program that binds all the number 2 variables. So psi 2, x 2, psi 2 to x 2, eta 2 to y 2, alpha 2 to a 2, and t 2 to tau 2. So you bind it along the 2 variables with the multiplication of 2 and 3 into 1. So this is one side of associativity. You run the program, and that's the output.
So what does the substitution replacing alpha 2?
Oh, that nothing. It's just to make things. The output comes out by the program as exponentials of alpha, but exponentials of alpha takes a lot of space. So instead, I replace it by alpha goes to uppercase alpha. So every time you see here an A1, it really means an exponential of alpha. I could remove this, and the only thing that will happen, is that the formula will appear a bit longer with some exponentials in it. It's a horrible mess. I don't care what it is. I only care to know that it's equal to the other side. So this is one side of the associative law, this is the other side of the associative law, that they better be equal. Let the computer compute, and the computer tells us that it's true. Now again, I might have cheated, but I didn't. In fact, the reason I've printed the one side before computing this was to tell you that it's a non-trivial equality.
Sorry, is this associativity or kind of...
This is associativity. This is associativity of the product in
in our order or in our algebra. So you have three inputs, 1 and 3, oh, 1, 2 and 3. You multiply 1 and 2, calling the result 2, and then multiply 2 and 3, and or you multiply 2 and 3 and then multiply 1 and 2. Okay? Maybe it's a bit confusing. The 2 in the middle, this 2, is really a dummy variable. It's where you store the output of the first computation, of the first product, before you multiply the second time. So, you know, if I will change this 2 to François, let me just say Fran, and here also to Fran, and here also to Fran, nothing will change because it's a dummy variable. Sorry, I didn't mean that. Nothing was. Okay. Similarly, you can check all the other axioms. Here is the antipodes and anti-homomorphism for multiplication. So if you do 2 antipodes, antipode on 1 and antipode on 2, then you multiply 1 and 2. It's the same as multiplying 2, 1 and then doing 1 antipode. So if we're lucky, this will give true. The next thing is something is a convolution inverse. So what's the
convolution? It's the convolution inverse of the identity.
Okay. So basically, if you do coproduct S on one side and then multiply again, you should be getting essentially a triviality. So I don't want to check what the right-hand side is. I don't want to write down what the right-hand side is. I just want to compute the left-hand side and hope that it comes out trivial. It does. Okay? If you think about it, this is the co-unit times the unit. Okay? It looks sufficiently trivial, and it is. Finally, here is the quasi-triangularity axioms, and here is the Rademeister 3 move. And the last thing I wanted to say, one more thing that I wanted to say is, you know, I pretended that I don't know too much about the form of P. But I actually do know a lot about the form of P, and I want to tell you what the form is, okay? And it's actually crucial. So, it was a better before, actually. Sorry. So, what's the form of P? So, definition, a docile perturbed Gaussian is a Gaussian times a power series in epsilon, where the degree of the term multiplying epsilon to the k is bounded by some simple function of k. In our case, it's 4k. Okay? And in fact, we can probably improve it to 2k plus 2, but that's a different issue. Okay? Why does it matter? This docility is the crucial point. This is the main point why everything works. Okay? The point is that suppose you have n strands. If you were using representation theory, you would associate your representation with each strand. You would need to take the nth tensor power of that representation. You would be looking at a space of exponential size, and any computation would take forever. If you are looking at our picture, but restricting your attention to up to epsilon to the k, you are looking at polynomials in roughly n variables, which are of degree bounded, which are of a priori bounded degree. This is a space of polynomial size. This is a space that grows polynomially in n. And that's exactly the crucial point. All of our invariants, all the operations, right? The operations are themselves, sort of, invariants and operations are belong to the same kind of spaces. So they're all of the form e to the l plus q times p, where l is a quadratic with scalar coefficients, and I write here more details about it. Q is a quadratic with coefficients which in themselves are in the ring of rational functions in the t variables and the uppercase alpha variables. And P is a docile power series. And now I can move on and compute the trefoil. So
sorry, how do you know that P is going to be docile in your case?
Oh, the computations show. Excellent question. You compute it to degree 2, 3, you find that it's true. You have an intuition why it should be true, and I didn't yet tell you what the intuition is. And so you say it's true, and it's the kind of and it's the kind of places where, you know, if you look at the first page of my handout, I say how proven this is docile and how implemented this is really important. So basically, it would be easy to prove how. I mean, there is, if you think about it, there is just. It's a matter of tracing through these differential equations and showing that nothing breaks. But I didn't go through it because it's not interesting.
And the R matrix is docile.
Oh, and the R matrix is docile because Fadeev formula is basically it's an exercise. It's not maybe it's an exercise that you bang your head against the wall for a while to solve, but it's not.
But
the moment the computations say it, who cares?
Suppose the people.
When we will write the paper, we will put something in, and it will be logically correct, but it will not be interesting.
Suppose the P was not docile, would certainly the program stop and complain, or
no.
Could give an answer?
It would give an answer, but not in polynomial time. Okay? So, seeing that our invariant is polytime, as I've already totally convinced you, okay? And seeing that the trefoil is tiny, 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 the program should compute the trefoil in no time at all. Okay? So, here is the trefoil. It's a product of three R matrices, one quap, and really to make it unframed, you have to add three kinks, and then you bind it with multiplication 10 times, and when I've added a timing outside, just so that you see how quick it is, timing will tell you how long it took to compute. So let's compute. It should take nothing. Nothing at all. Zero time. Wait, what's going on? Somebody told you lies? Roland, did you mess up with the program? What's going on here? Okay. So obviously I have to give excuses. So let me give the excuse. One, the program is completely inefficient in many, many ways. This doesn't explain this pathetic behavior. Two, the real way to compute the trefoil, the best way to compute the trefoil, is as I have explained last time. Namely, you project the trefoil, and then you sort of add crossings in a certain order, but keeping the width as little as possible so as to have as few variables as you can. For the trefoil, you can never go above two strands, in fact. But that's not what we do. What we do is we basically multiply. We basically, first of all, create the trefoil, the quap, and three kinks. Hasn't finished yet. Let's see if I can finish the explanation before it finishes. So basically. You create all of these objects, there are zillions of strands here, and only then you glue them, so you're looking at way too many variables. So basically, you're I'm computing the trefoil with a presentation for the trefoil that looks more like a knot with 12 crossings. That's a bigger part of the explanation. A knot with 12 crossings taking 108 seconds, it's still pathetic. Okay? But now is the biggest part of the explanation. The biggest part of the explanation is that I actually lied to you. And I lied to you right here. Things are docile, but with coefficients that are themselves in a certain ring of rational functions in very many variables. So basically, if you have n strands, then you have 2n variables. And if you're looking at polynomials of a certain degree in 2n variables, polynomials of roughly degree n in roughly 2n variables, that grows exponentially. Okay? So I lied. However, if you actually follow what the T gluing do, you find that when you have, here you have a separate T variable for each component. And once you compute everything and you get the trefoil, there is only one strand. So there is only one T variable. And in fact, the T gluings simply turn all variables, T1, T2, T3, T4, and so on, just simply turn all of them to T1. And nothing depends on... Basically, you could have done this conversion at the beginning, and you'll get the same output. This is if you only use multiplication. If you try to use the co-multiplication actually cares about which T you have. But if you only plan to multiply things, you can set all the T's to be the same. So I could have rewritten the computation as here by basically turning all the T's to T1. And also after each computational stage, turning all the T's to T1. Each computational stage might have created new T's, and I can still turn all of them to T1. So that's not the most efficient way to do it, but let's see how it does. So now I can give you the excuses about this isn't the right way to compute, this is a pathetic program, but it's still a lot better. So that's, and I'll stop here. Roland, did I completely eat your time?
Yeah, I think I still have some.
Okay. Good. Thank you.